This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Indran Amirthanayagam, and he was born in Sri Lanka, and he has traveled the world. And we will find out all about it. But what are you going to tell us for your opening poem?
Grace, I'm going to begin with a poem called Boy. I wrote this after the tsunami of 2004. Boy. Hospital bed, bungalow. A boy recovers from his wounds, cared for now by doctors and his uncle. From time to time, he dials his parents' cell number, says he'll heal, then return to Yala. Ask the elephants and birds to find Appa and Amma. Ask the elephants and birds to find Appa and Amma. Of course, Appa and Amma disappeared in that great and terrible wave.
The voice of Indran Amirthanayagam. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. How do you, as a cultural ambassador, keep your public duties and still maintain the heart of a poet?
Because my father was a poet and a diplomat for Sri Lanka. A great uncle of mine founded Poetry London, the magazine, the only poetry magazine that published every month during the war out of London. So I have these models in my family that really inspired me and inspire me today. And then I always thought, I always think about the story of Pablo Neruda when he was Chile's ambassador to Paris. And in between meetings in taxis, he would write his poems. And he would make of his day a poetic statement. You know, he loved theater, and he would dress up as a waiter, and he would serve his appointments coffee. So life is a party, or can be, it can be a game, it can be fun. Even in the midst of tragedy, one needs to laugh and one needs to relax and find tranquility. And poetry has been my way of rediscovering constantly that tranquility.
And joy. I'm going to tell them a little bit about who you are. You write poetry in English, Spanish, French, Portuguese, Haitian Creole. You've published 11 collections of poetry. Your essays and poems have been in the New York Times, the Hindu, Reforma, El Norte, the Indian Express. You have worked all over the countries. Let me just name some of these places where you've been. You have been the public affairs counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince right now. You've been regional environmental officer for South America and public affairs officer in Vancouver, Monterey, and Chennai. Environment, science, technology, and health counselor office in Mexico City and Abidjan. Then assistant cultural affairs officer in Brussels, and also an officer in Buenos Aires. Let me ask you, is there a thread from country to country about poetry and regarding poetry that you see as consistent, or is it different, dramatically different in some countries?
I think we all, human beings everywhere, have our paradise in our heart, in our minds, and perhaps that paradise is lost and needs to be recovered, regained. So we have that myth that drives us of a paradise either lost or a paradise to be found. And, you know, that's also the myth that drives the immigrant, you know, and the traveler who looks for a better life, who pursues life, liberty, and happiness, but elsewhere, leaving civil war or leaving economic ruin, or always thinking of the children, of the future. So, you know, that story, which is very much the story of our times, of emigration, of movement, comes into the poetry that I happen to write. I, too, have a paradise lost, regained, or to be regained, an island paradise where I was born, the island of Ceylon, no longer known as Ceylon, now known as Sri Lanka. And I have traveled from that island, and I have been lucky enough to have always found myself on islands. And I think an island, the life of an island, of living on an island, has always influenced my poetry. If you think of the Earth, one thinks of that we live on Earth, but we actually live on a planet called ocean. I mean, in the sense that most of the planet is water, and water moves, and my poetry moves from line to line. The human beings who populate the poems move, and when you move, you have to give up something you love, and
that's in your work.
That's in
and
the work.
I want to have everyone share that. Read us two more poems right now.
With pleasure. You must love the land. When you leave to build your house on the sea, love what's lost, the mango tree burning in the garden, the curious noose of the familiar coat of arms. Love the ball turning strong, spinning in a dark, faraway land. Love the tongue you'll never again speak, that wrapped you and bled you and dried up some every day on the other side of the sea. A poem I wrote way back in 1990, and I would just mention that Alistair Reid, who I admire greatly, a great poet and translator, essays, he touched that poem up for me. So thank you, Alistair, wherever you are now, who has gone over to the other side. The elephants are in the yard. I see the elephants in the yard, Papa, the white snake too, peering out of the neem tree's trunk, hissing poisons. Papa, I see the wild boar in the thicket, the branches burning with his smell. Papa, bring out your gun, I want to eat the boar's meat and stare at his head on my wall. Papa, I see the elephants in the yard. The partridge and jungle fowl you shot from the air and bush to conquer alone the harvest of the jungle. You were always a sport, took on bird in flight, bore in fierce charge your life or his. I see the elephants in the yard, and poachers cock-eyed, devouring their tusks in dreams, building grand compounds, massing riches in stainless steel. Papa, the sport is finished. The elephants are in the yard, and there is no forest, and there are lots of knives and forks and tractors and babies to feed and gorillas hiding in the shade of neem and mango, right there, beyond the veranda, in the center of the garden where your dowry will build your last daughter's house. The elephants spread their heavy bodies, tired from the journey up country and down country, the long herding to some safe, peaceful house.
Oh, that is marvelous. Yeah. That gives you the whole environment, the whole tone, the whole nature of a way of life. That is beautiful. Give us another.
Yeah, and you know, these elephants, they have no forest left. They're in your backyard. Take care of them. Address them. Be responsible for them. Be responsible for your fellow
elephants.
Exactly.
You know, that is why your poetry is singular, because the imagery could not come from anyone else.
And that's a poem that goes back to a book called The Elephants of Reckoning.
Yes.
A settling of accounts with that past. The elephants who ask you, why did you leave? Why did you leave
this
island?
It's a wonderful book. I recommend it.
And here a more recent poem from a book called Uncivil War. Again, about this theme of movement and migration, ready to move. We are Mayans, we are Tamils, we are Armenians, we are Germans who lived once in Poland, we are Burkinabes stuck in Abidjan, Somalians in Maine and Massachusetts. We are witnesses to the only truth worth repeating. Have a bag of essentials, holy book, toothbrush, a fresh set of clothes, ready to put on your back when historical conditions change suddenly.
Such accuracy, such precision. Your stanza is just moderate. Your tones are so equalized. Who has influenced you, and what tradition of poetry do you come from?
You know, I've been lucky enough through the learning different languages and writing in them to have different models and traditions in which I've, but they're all influenced by the lyric. I the imagist poetry of that Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams made famous in the early part of the 20th century certainly influences my poetry. And Allen Ginsberg in the early days of poems, including his songs, a song like Father Death Blues after his father died, as well as his long, precise poems like the elegy for his mother, Kaddish. I had the privilege and the luck of knowing Alan early on in my life through my father, who was his friend. And so naturally I was influenced by that presence of the poet close to me. And I was 17. We were in Honolulu at the time. I was in school there at Punahou School. I went with my father to pick Alan up at the airport. And he came back and he had his slack key guitar, his harmonium with him, and he played a song called Sweet Oahu. And then we get home to the house and the phone rings. This is 1977 spring. And I pick up the phone and it's Bob Dylan calling for Allen Ginsberg. Imagine what a young poet, a 17-year-old poet, feels when Bob Dylan is calling for Allen Ginsberg, with whom he was working at the time on Rolling Thunder Review.
I consider that a blessing. You were given a celestial blessing.
That's
which
right.
Said, go, young man, and do your thing.
So I felt like it was a messenger between. Exactly. So I learned from these experiences. I learned poetry not necessarily in school, but
would have killed your spirit.
But I have nothing against the MFA programs and so on. But early on, I decided to learn my poetry out in the fields and in the cities. Yes, certainly I needed a job, and I found a very good job for me, which was to represent my new country, my adopted country, the United States, as a diplomat abroad. And I had a sinecured life. I was a poet in New York. I used to run reading series. I had a series called Word of Mouth, which I used to run out of the Chinatown branch of the public library. I served on the New York State Council in the Arts Literature Panel. I had a certain kind of right and comforts of, but the challenge of leaving. I guess there must be something in me that insists on leaving, even and perhaps that
and the pain of leaving.
Yeah, but I don't want to become a professional leaver, but I do. I think I wanted to challenge myself and go beyond that island of Manhattan again out into the larger world, and I did. I came to Washington, became a diplomat, went abroad to Argentina first, and then from there carried on for the last 20 years in different parts of the world.
And now you are operating out of the embassy in Port-au-Prince.
That's right.
Haiti. How do they regard you as a poet there?
It's a very lovely culture, the strong support for the arts, Haitian art. Haiti produces wonderful music and painting and literature.
Are you known as a poet?
Yes, I mean I tend to be a little quiet about my poetry just because I'm there as a diplomat and working. But I certainly I'm not shy about the poetry either. I meet with Haitians of all professions and styles, and to advance our work in the country. And certainly I meet with the Haitian writers and the poets too. I write in French and I write in Creole. So naturally I learn from my contacts and friends in the Haitian culture. I learn the language. I think that that's been the greatest discovery for me as a diplomat.
Is it easy for you to learn languages?
You know, funny thing, I was at a Tamil. I mean, I used to speak the Tamil language, and I forgot Tamil. And I grew up only with English, English being also my mother tongue. But the forgetting of Tamil led to an insecurity about learning languages for me. And then when I had to overcome that by learning Spanish first and then French well, And then writing in the languages as well.
Yes. You make it more global. Yeah. But Love in Lima sounds like a good thing to have.
Yes,
and
it is.
With that, I'm going to tell them everyone that at the Library of Congress is Indran Amarthanayagam. And he's come to us in a whirlwind tour through America. And he is residing now at the embassy, serving our country in Port-au-Prince. May I please have another poem?
With pleasure. This one is called Kiss. Kissing your lips, I try to forget roses or the fruit of Palmyra trees, sweet and strong. Tongue lolling upon tongue, heart beating against heart beating. These are my words signifying our human bodies, which poetry does not capture. The absolute desire I have to kiss your lips on this hot and sunny afternoon. I do not know how much longer I can walk about the garden kissing roses or perambulate the toddy tavern of my dreams where black faces and white toddy mix in black and white memories of Jaffna, Sri Lanka, my Tamil country, far away on an island across the sea.
Mm.
Far away and far away, the Palmyra fruit in your lips to drink toddy now. To kiss your rosy lips now, to uproot the roses in my garden and offer them upon my tongue now, to fly to Sri Lanka and grab the last fruit on the tree before history throws the Tamils into the sea, as is said it will do. Before all this and everything else, before the apocalypse, I do so sincerely wish, though my words may not fit, to rest my head in your hair and kiss your lips.
That is in the greatest tradition of love poetry.
Yeah.
And that is so lyrical. It is among your most lyrical of all poems.
I wanted to read, one in English. And so that even in the English language, one can fall in love, though French and Spanish are easier.
Putting your modesty aside, what are some of the things people love about your poetry? What's some of the praising? We can hear a little bit of the praise. What has someone said that you liked?
Well, I think saying truth in simple, clear language, to precise language, and capturing that sort of music. And, you know, you may know the poem, I'm sure you do, of Gaddafi, where he talks about the music of that Alexandria that you're losing, that city that you're losing, the trying to capture that music of in words. So making words like notes, words like dance steps. So there's something that happens. It's a scene. The stage. The stage of the poem is the page,
mm-hmm.
and on that page, there is a whole life taking place flowering and moving and dancing.
The one thing I felt about your poetry is it is without deception. There is no showboating, no manipulation, no attempt to persuade. It is the finest thing I could say. And so I do want to hear more. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Thank you, Grace. A couple of recent poems. This one is called By All Means, a Whale. The humpback whale has swum from beyond Cape Cod to frolic with her pup in the warm, cool waters off Samana. The migratory reach of birds, fish, and mammals is the subject of a million doctoral theses, but no one has yet to explain pure chance, coincidence, why I happened to see this particular mother and child on Saturday morning. The fact that I bought an excursion on a whale watching tour, that I was guaranteed a whale or another tour free of charge, are mere helpers of fate. The boat could have sprung a leak, the car taking me to port run out of gas. My imagination might have surprised me moving from observed reality to dream and fantasy. I did put Moby Dick in my bag just in case. So you see, one has to laugh a bit and the absurdity of the comedy of life. And I think that is there, perhaps.
Your joy is there. You also observe many of the struggles in the world because you've seen them and witness them and live them. But there is underneath your poetry a sense of vitality and truly a love of life. Is that true?
Yes, I think so. I'm an optimist, not a pessimist. I mean, you know, the two sides of the coin. And I think poetry does heal and does save. And it saved me. I wrote a poem once after seeing lovers on the subway in New York called So Beautiful that I was so depressed that evening when I returned home. I didn't have a job. I was a student. I had a lot of student debt to pay back. And just that love that I saw and felt on the streets of New York that Saturday evening came back to me, and I was blessed with the poem, which it's actually one of my well-known poems because it was part of the United States of Poetry, a PBS documentary that was really a very wonderful show. And you know, I love the transformation, the saving grace of poetry.
Oh, yes.
What more? You know, I've been, my father and mother both, my mother taught me to read. Not my father, but my father as a poet helped me, guided me by just the books that we had on the walls, in our bookcases. My mother has been ill, but she's doing much better. And yet, but I wrote this poem recently during her this illness, which is an illness that many older people suffer, you know. The poem is called Delirious Together. My mum's gone batty, apparently, visiting the thrift shop every day, buying Wedgwood china, silver-plated photo albums, bed sheets, chairs, eyeing a new table for the back. All to be understood, but she wants to give what she buys to her children, already twice grown with kids of their own approaching college. Is this a second childhood, the giver who refuses time? Her brain is unscathed, but the behavior will not conform. Damn you, living within your means. I can walk, I can take the bus, and I can get a fellow to bring the stuff back in his truck. Mummy, one kid calls you cunning, another obstinate, rock hard, but I felt you say, I love you very much the day I left, in every corpuscle of blood. False alarm too, that departure. I will return, all of us will, from Ceylon, Canada, England, the US of America. Damn exile, damn money, your riotous laugh. Run up the credit cards until the levy breaks, but society, order, the cleaning service will be in charge now, and we will channel the flood, keep blood flowing in the skin. Mommy, you were a powerful natural god. 79 years of fight, we doff our hats before your force, your life, we join your laughter now.
What an enormous honor to her generosity. Whether it's excessive right now or what the impulse is to spend money, there is at the heart of it the wish to give.
Yes,
that's a great poem.
Yeah.
And before we go to your final poem, if you were to teach, and I do not know if you do teach, and you enter the classroom, what would be the first thing you'd want to say about poetry? What's the most important thing that comes off your head right this minute? You've said a lot of important things throughout this program.
The first thing that comes to mind is undress. Undress your mind, undress your heart, undress your soul. Undress in any level of undressing you wish to do. And if you want to literally take off your coat, in a sense, I mean, not undress to be stark naked before you, but the symbolic notion of undressing and the revelation that comes with the undressing.
Was it hard for you to find the courage to be vulnerable?
At times, some poems, but then once the poem is written, it needs to be read and shared. For me, I have this impulse. A poem dies an unpleasant and lonely death if not shared, if not read, if not published, or if not. I send drafts of poems to friends through email. I keep the poem, it has life once it moves out of the hands and mind of the writer and becomes part of the common intellectual, emotional property of the society.
Because you are a communicator of the heart. And now we would like a final poem.
Thank you. I'll recite this one, thinking again of that wave, the tsunami. It was a poem called Face, which came in a book, The Splintered Face, Tsunami Poems. Imagine half your face rubbed out, yet you're suited up and walking to the office. How will your mates greet you with heavy hearts, flowers, rosary beads? How shall we greet the orphan boy, the husband whose hands slipped, children and wife swept away? How to greet our New Year's and our birthdays? Shall we always light a candle? Do we remember that time erases the show, grass grows, pains modified? At Hikkaduwa in 1980, I wrote a ditty, a sailor's song, about rain and sunny Ceylon. I don't know what Calypsonians would compose about this monstrous wave, this blind hatchet man. Don't know the byless singer's reply. We are a happy and go people, yet the fisherman's wife knows that her grandfather was eaten by the ocean. Fisher communities have suffered in time. And what's happened now is just another feast for that bloody sleeping mother lapping at our island. But what if the ocean were innocent, the tectonic plates innocent? What if God were innocent? I do not know how to walk upon the beach, how to lift corpse after corpse until I'm exhausted, how to stop the tears when half my face has been rubbed out beyond the railroad tracks, and this anesthetic, this calypso come to the last verse. What shall we write in the sand? Where are gravestones incinerated? Whose ashes are these urned and floating through a house throttled by water? Shall we build a memorial some calculated distance from the sea in a park in the shape of a giant wave where we could write the names of the dead? Has the wave lost its beauty, considered now obscene? Yet tomorrow, tomorrow we must go to the ocean and refresh ourselves in the sea breeze down in Hikkaduwa where it is raining in sunny Ceylon. Tomorrow we must renew our vows at sunrise, at sunset. Let us say, the next time the ocean recedes and parrots gawk and flee and restless dogs insist their humans wake up, we will not peer at the revelation of the ocean bed, nor seek photographs. We will run to higher ground, and gathered there with our children, our cats, our dogs, our pigs, with what we've carried in our hands, albums, letters, we will make a circle, kneel, sit, stand in no particular direction, and pray, and be silent, and open our lungs, and shout thanks to our gods, thanks to our dogs.
Thank you, Grace. The passion and the voice of Indran Amirthanayagam. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support by Friends of Poetry, Maria Van Buren, Longin Ambrose, and Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.